Welcome to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. I'm your host, Evan Epstein. In this episode, I talk with Heidi Rosen, a venture capitalist, corporate director, and one of the most networked people in Silicon Valley. She's currently a partner at Threshold Ventures and serves on the boards of private companies Zooks, Planet, Polar, and Memphis Meats, in addition to publicly traded companies Daily Mail and General Trust, which is listed in the London Stock Exchange, and Invitation Homes, listed in the New York Stock Exchange. Heidi has had a stellar career in the tech industry in Silicon Valley and has served on dozens of boards since the 1990s. She has also authored many articles on venture capital and corporate governance, all of which makes her an ideal guest for this podcast. In addition to her investing in board positions, Heidi co-leads Stanford's Threshold Venture Fellows Program in the Management Science and Engineering Department and serves on the Advisory Council for Stanford's Institute for Human-Centered Artificial Intelligence. If you like this show, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast with colleagues or friends. If you'd like to reach out to me, you can find me on LinkedIn or Twitter at Evan Epstein. You can also check out all the details related to this podcast, including show notes and reference materials, at www.boardroom-governance.com. Heidi, it is an incredible pleasure to have you in this podcast. We've known each other for a while at Stanford when we were running programs for directors in the venture space and in the public space. So it's a big honor that you come in to this podcast. And as usual, what I try to do is start with your origin story, your personal side, before we dig into the governance question. So let's start with that.
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me here and congratulations on your role. And it's all very exciting. So nice to see you in this context. I have a very boring story. I was born here. So what can I say? You know, I didn't have to go very far. I'm one of the rare Silicon Valley natives. My parents were both European immigrants. And my father, when I was young, once said to me, honey, you don't have to go anywhere. I've searched the whole world. I've already put you in the best place. So
amazing.
Yeah, so I think he was right.
Okay. And so then you ended up going to college at Stanford. And you graduated in 1980, which was an important year for the computer industry. Tell us about, you know, what happened after you graduated. I know you started a company, so tell us about that story.
Yeah, I mean, the brief history there is again, right place, right time. You know, I graduated from Stanford in 1980, although I had a degree in creative writing. So not a techie. I was a fuzzy, as they call it at Stanford. But because the computer industry was really just taking off at that time, my first job out of college was actually working as the editor of the company newspaper for Tandem Computers, which was a high flyer early computer company in 1980. And I got there, and what I realized is everybody who was getting ahead either had an MBA or an engineering degree. And I felt it was probably too late for me to go back and become an engineer, but business school seemed like a good idea. And so I applied to Stanford Business School and I got in. And I also had the very good fortune to have a brilliant programmer as an older brother. And so while I was in business school, my brother had been writing this program for early computers, CPM computers. And he and I decided to go into business together and started this company called TeamMaker, which I ended up being at for more than a decade.
Okay. So now that I think about it, you're like the OG newsletter writer. you were a very early newsletter writer. And so you ran that company for 10 years. Then you went to Apple.
I did, yes. So I actually ran that company, I think it was close to 14 years.
Okay.
From the time we started it till we sold the company, and then I ran it for the acquirer for 18 months. And then I was recruited to Apple to be VP of Worldwide Developer Relations. I had been on the other side of that as an early Mac developer. In fact, our company was the fifth product to ship for the Mac way back in, you know, March of 1984. So had a long history with Apple. Was a critic of Apple in the true sense of the word, both positive and negative. And they recruited me to come in and run developer relations at a time that was frankly a very dark time for Apple. It's really amazing now to think of it as often the most valuable company on earth, when at the time the quarter I joined, it was very, very close to bankruptcy. So it's really not my fault.
But that was pre the job reentering as a CEO.
Correct. Yeah. That was, I actually left shortly after Apple acquired Next. So had not come back as CEO yet, but I spent a year there and it was a really interesting year. I learned a lot. I feel like I made some contributions, but the flip side is the corporate world was not for me. My kids were 1 and 3 at the time and I never saw them. And I just didn't like the role. I mean, frankly, it just turned into something where from a personal perspective, I just didn't enjoy the work.
Okay. And so the next step, you have the history of joining the venture capital industry with SoftBank, which...
Although I'll tell you, there was actually something else in between that was really pivotal. So when I had been running my own little software company, I had become very involved in the trade association. At the time, it was called the Software Publishers Association, and had, it's a volunteer organization, but I had become a member of the board and ultimately was elected president. And that's partially why Apple recruited me to run developer relations, because I had this very broad network of other software entrepreneurs. The day after I left Apple, Doug Burgum, who today is actually the governor of North Dakota, but at the time he was the CEO of a company called Great Plains Software. And Great Plains was preparing to go public. And Doug called me and he said, I would really like to strengthen my board before I go public. And I would like to join my board of directors. So I joined his board in 1997, right before it went public. And that was my first board experience of being, being a
director
and ultimately a public company director. Mm. And I really enjoyed that experience. And I ended up getting recruited to some other private company boards. Also some companies that were private that went public. One of which was an early operating system company. And that in turn is what attracted Gary Richelle and the other partners at what was the new SoftBank Venture Capital to recruit me there. It was really my board experience, more than my experience as an investor, because technically I had not been an investor before.
Right. So that's really interesting, because you were typically the first outside director in these private companies?
Oh yeah, very often. I was the first outside director. I was very often the first and only woman to join these boards. And, all the companies were tech companies, so very male dominated. And it was a fascinating experience to join these boards and to try to help these companies become successful. And because I had been a CEO myself, I think I had a lot of empathy for the role of the CEO. And then ultimately, when I became a VC, I also had already worked with a lot of other VCs with whom I sat on these boards. And so had an experience observing venture capital, but now in 1999, I came into the field myself.
Well, that's great, because when we will touch upon the governance questions, I think we'll talk a lot about the role of the independent director and, your experience back in the 90s. Compared with, over the decades, and particularly now, I'm very interested in having a contrast of that. But if we just jump back to SoftBank, I mean, what was SoftBank then as compared to the current, Vision Fund? And was Masayoshi also involved in those days? Yeah. I mean,
it was Masa. It's always been Masa.
Right.
Masa is a huge, big thinker and a big visionary. And I remember even back then when he would say, I have a 300-year plan, I would think to myself, good Lord, nobody has a 300-year plan. So SoftBank was the limited partner to the venture fund. Mm-hmm. He was not involved in the decision-making. He was not involved in prospecting the deals or the employee decisions or anything. I mean, really, he was our major limited partner. So we didn't have that much overlap with him, but he was a big thinker back then, and he is a big thinker now. And in fact, SoftBank just led an investment in a company called Memphis Meats, a company that I'm on the board of and very involved with. So we still we still, I guess, have a company in common here.
Yeah. No, that's really interesting. And the venture capital industry, certainly you've seen the peaks and the bottoms. So how was it in those years?
Well, look, you know, I joke that my timing was either the best or the worst timing in the world to become a venture capitalist, because I became one in 1999. And my first two companies I invested in went public within 6 months and 10x the valuations. And it seemed like this VC stuff was pretty damn easy. And then the dot-com bust happened. And, I had made 6 investments, and it turned from something where, as Bill Campbell used to like to say, everything was up and to the right, to something where everything was in a crisis and you had to do a lot of triage. And frankly, not that dissimilar from what I and a lot of other people are experiencing over the last 3 or 4 months, right? Where you really have this cataclysmic change in the economy, and you are things that are moving in a, you know, in the past may have been moving in a positive direction, in part because the economy was moving and, you know, all ships were rising, and now you're facing something dramatically different. So the dot-com bust, which really was more isolated to tech and not as pervasive in the economy, but deeply, deeply in the tech economy, where I think that the tech economy just got way ahead of itself. There were, you know, many years of digging that out and resolving that and doing the best you could with those companies and their products and their customers and their employees, and trying to, you know, either find a home for them or as I used to call them, exits with honor. That didn't necessarily mean you were making your money back, but it meant you were finding the best outcome possible for those companies. And it's hard work in those environments, but I think it's also the right thing to do. And luckily I had a partnership that was very supportive of trying to do the right thing, as I do now. I'm very happy to be with a partnership that also is the first goal is to try to do the right thing. And so you do that work. I mean, that's the job.
Right. And so one of the things that is interesting is that there's a famous case study about you back, and I think it was originally written in the year 2000. So around those days in which you were, a VC. And I think I read the case study, and it's all about how you manage your network and your connections and the strength of, you know, consistency and performance. And tell us about what happened at Columbia, because I think that story is really interesting when they taught your case using the name Howard.
Yes. Berkeley. Yes. So first of all, it's a Harvard Business School case. Mm-hmm. And it was written by a professor there at Harvard who was interested in having a female, wanted to write a case around building a business network and wanted a female protagonist. And she had read about me. There had been this article in USA Today calling me like the connector of Silicon Valley or something. And so she had read the article and she approached me and said, would you be willing to be the protagonist of a case about building a business network? And I said, well, I don't know anything about that. And she said, no, I think you do, you know, based on this article I read, I think you have something there. So she really teased it out of me, and it was an interesting process. And after I read the case, I said, you know, I think a lot of this is just common sense. And she said, no, you'd be surprised. It's not. So remarkably, the case really has legs, so to speak. I mean, here it is 20 years later, and the case is still being taught at almost all the major business schools. Sadly, not Stanford anymore.
Really?
They taught it until about 3 years ago, and then whoever was teaching it isn't teaching it anymore. But it's still taught at Harvard and Wharton and a lot of international schools, and I end up speaking about it frequently, actually, on Zoom. But I get invited to be a guest speaker at various graduate schools to talk about the case. But anyway, so the interesting thing about the case is a number of years ago, a professor by the name of Francis Flynn decided to run an experiment. And so he had 2 sections of first year MBA students. I think he did this experiment at Columbia, actually, was the first time he did it. And he got permission from Harvard, so he changed the case. So the only difference was that in one case I was Heidi Roizen and the other one I was Howard Roizen. And then he taught the sections of the 2 classes independently. And then at the end, they were asked to take a survey about how did they think about the professionalism and productivity and the business acumen of Howard and Heidi, and then who did they want to work with? And it turned out that people thought Howard and Heidi were equally competent. You know, there's 60 students in one section, 60 students in the other section. All of the students across those two sections graded Heidi and Howard about the equivalent level of competency. However, they really wanted to work with Howard much more than with Heidi, and felt that Heidi was a sort of a looking out for herself kind of person, and that Howard was just a genuinely nicer guy. So
that's fascinating.
And you know, I jokingly refer to myself as the poster child for subtle gender bias, but it really is the case that it's exactly the same case, and it's just that people's interpretation of the person based on the gender was different for Howard versus Heidi.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really interesting case study. And so after your time as a VC, you joined a few boards, some of them public. Mm-hmm. So TiVo and some international boards, right? Yellow Pages, yes, of Canada and the Daily Mail, General Trust in the UK. Yep. Tell us about the contrast of serving in the US versus serving in a publicly traded Canadian and or English company.
Sure. So I'm still on the DMGT board. I've been there for eight years now. I was their first woman, which I teased them because they were, I think, 125-year-old company when I became a woman director. They've since added, so that's good. But they're wonderful. They're wonderful people, actually. You know, in many ways, governance is governance. And there are certainly differences, particularly when it comes to I would say, regulation and accounting and things like that. I mean, DMGT is a company that also has a pension. It has a dividend. That's very different than the companies I tend to work with in Silicon Valley. So there are some different things. You're obviously living under a different tax code. But at the end of the day, they're businesses, and you're trying to make decisions with the best business judgment, and you're trying to help navigate what do we, you know, as I jokingly say, what do we want to be when we grow up? You know, how should this company evolve? And you're trying to help the CEO and the chairman and the leadership team have a perspective. And I think, you know, frankly, one of the reasons they recruited me was to get that Silicon Valley perspective. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are a big part of their business is being a media company and a literally print newspaper company, which is something that obviously has been under attack for many years now by internet media and other things. And so I really enjoy that work. I enjoy trying to be that person who is, I'd say sometimes I'm a difficult person on those boards and I'm a contrarian. And mm-hmm. I really appreciate that Jonathan, the chairman, who is, you know, he's generationally, you know, he's the fourth generation of his family involved in this enterprise. Jonathan and Paul, the CEO, appreciate that I can be difficult.
Right.
And I'm difficult in a really nice way.
So a question on that. Do you think that this trend of having transnational directors, so if you're operating in China, operating in Asia and Europe, is going to be more prevalent or less? I mean, I suppose now with COVID, things are changing. I don't know. Do you have a travel schedule where you have to go and spend?
I'm laughing because literally, yes, we had our board meeting yesterday, mm-hmm. and the board meetings are at 9 o'clock in the morning in London. Mm-hmm. And it didn't occur to anybody that maybe now in a COVID world, we might want to change the timing of that board meeting. And I didn't think about it until last week sometime when I asked them, and it was too hard to change it. So there's one other California-based director and I, and we were, we had to get up we were on the board call from 1 a.m. to 4:30 a.m. Wow. I said, hey, that is not my best time. and I'm not going to look good. I'm not putting makeup on it. You know, I'm not for that time. So it was a little comical, but, I think that, if you're willing to, and obviously, you know, I've made many, many trips to London since I've been on that board. Less so now because you get to know everybody. And actually, a lot of DMGT's business, one of their biggest companies, subsidiaries, RMS, is here in Silicon Valley. So part of, I think, why they wanted someone like me and Dominique Trempont, the other U.S. director on the board, is because they have a lot of interest in U.S. And in U.S. tech, mm-hmm. as they have been diversifying over the last 25, 30 years. So I don't necessarily, I think, look, every company is unique. And every company, I think, when they think about directors, they should be thinking who best reflects our customer, our employee base, our markets, our potential, the direction we're going, what kind of people, you know, boards or teams, what kind of people can you put on the team to be, have your company be its best self going forward? And so for some of those companies, and certainly DMGT being a global organization with subsidiaries and practices around the world, and as I said, some of their largest and most important ones right here in the US, it made a lot of sense for them to bring Dominique and myself onto the board because we reflect the you know, we live in the world that they are investing in here in California, and it is a unique world. I mean, it is, yeah. You know, even talking about things like, you know, like I'll give you an example that is no, you know, I don't think a surprise to anybody, but obviously there've been a lot of layoffs because of COVID. There's been a lot of job disruption, but not so much in technical roles, right? You know, the ability for programmers to continue almost seamlessly working from home has been quite remarkable. And if you ask anyone in Silicon Valley right now, the top companies, Google, Facebook, you know, all the biggies,
yeah,
they are recruiting against the other companies, right? They are targeting the best people at companies that people may consider to be less of a safe bet than working for a Google or a Facebook. And so there was an interesting perspective that, oh, well, you know, we don't have to worry about that right now because nobody's recruiting. And those of us who are here in Silicon Valley could educate them to the fact that because the CEO here of RMS was saying, you know, hey, you know, there's a lot of recruiting going on here. And we could validate that right away to say, absolutely, this is the nature of what's going on here. So I think it's very helpful for them to have, you know, both Dominique and I sit on multiple boards of largely technology-based, you know, technology companies based on the West Coast. And so we just have a different perspective. But I don't think it necessarily means that every foreign company, you know, there's a lot of overhead associated with having a foreign director, not the least of which is the travel. And, you know, you have to learn a different set of rules and regulations. And I don't necessarily think that every company needs to populate their boards with a bunch of foreigners. I think it really depends on what the business proposition is and how global do you have to be.
Right. Okay. So then, and now you're back in the, well, you've been back in the venture business at DFJ and now with Threshold. You know, how was that transition? And can you tell us a little bit more about that side?
Sure. So I re-entered VC 8 years ago, eight and a half now. Time flies when you're having fun. And it is, it's great. I mean, so much of VC is the same, right? You're trying to find the best people with the best ideas to go and either create or disrupt large markets. And that's what we do. And that has not changed. The technology's changed, the market's changed somewhat, but ultimately finding those small groups of people with incredible passion and brilliant ideas and the tenacity to pursue them and investing that capital and helping them from the sidelines, that hasn't changed. And so the job is not different than it was 20 years ago. It's the same job.
Okay. Yeah. No, I completely agree with that. So let's talk on some of the governance questions here. So even though the business side of investing hasn't changed, there have been some questions on governance of these private venture-backed companies, right?
Absolutely.
On the one hand, we do have cases where Some of the unicorns have been questioned, right? The Theranos, Uber, WeWork, yep. Where I find there are a special category, right? Because they're very large companies that have some private level governance, but they are bigger than your typical startup. Mm-hmm. And essentially, the problematic areas where there are conflicts occur in financings and down rounds, yep. Occur in the sale of the company or in recaps. And, you know, how do you see that? I mean, has there been a change in terms of how directors think about these situations where you have heightened fiduciary duties and, or is just, it's the same business as usual and you got to be a little bit more careful. I mean, how do you perceive that in terms of an investor in these boards or an independent director?
Yeah. So in some ways it is in some ways it's the same, right? But there have been some meta factors that have, I think, changed the landscape and changed the visibility of these issues. First of all, these companies have just stayed private way longer than they used to, right? And they got way bigger than they used to. And so when you're a lot bigger and you're a private for a lot longer and you're touching that much more of your community and customers and you've raised tremendous amounts of money and often that money has come in multiple rounds at different valuations and different places on the preference stack, you really have investors with very unaligned interests. And so, and then if you hit a down market like we are right now in many ways, you're going to test a lot of that. And so I just think that it's gotten more complicated. And then overlay on that a second point, which I think has been covered very well, for example, in the case of Uber, it's been covered pretty well in the case of WeWork. For a while, you know, when a market is hot and it's a seller's market, mm-hmm. There were certain things that became, I'll use the word trendy for lack of a better way to put it, but when you're in competitive and you're trying to win a deal and an entrepreneur says, well, I don't want governance. I want to have supermajority. I want to have control. I want to have all the voting shares. Mm-hmm. To win that deal, sometimes there are people who say, okay, yes. And that happens. And it means that the governance is not not a typical governance structure. And so I think, again, if you go read all the material on WeWork and Uber, and we're not in either of those, those were cases where the founders had supermajority.
Yeah.
And that creates a very different, now, you know, Facebook also had it, Google also had it, though I would love to be an investor in, you know, again. As an investor,
right.
You can, and I mean, again, Bill Gurley at Benchmark has written about the fact that Uber, you know, was a very challenging situation for him and them at Benchmark. The flip side, it's probably one of the best venture returns of all time. So you can't, you know, this is a gray area. This is not an area where it's like, oh, supermajority is bad and mm-hmm. proper governance is good and the best outcomes always happen when you have that. That's not the case. This is an evolving sort of thing. And yes, I suppose on rare occasion, there are arguments one can make for concentrating the voting power into the founding team. But I can also give you an argument on the other side that says, I believe all companies should have governance because at the end of the day, as you grow and you bring on more stakeholders, that you have to have people who are paying attention to that. And by stakeholders, I also mean customers, employees, community. I'm a big believer. Yes, we are there to, especially private companies, and I'm a fiduciary for our limited partners. And so I consider it very important for me to always be looking out for how can our investment become both a good investment and a liquid investment. Mm-hmm. But that said, there are more stakeholders than just the investors. And so I think, you know, in many ways, these are the things that have caused these changes and these things to come to light.
Well, one thing, you know, as I was researching, you know, your background and different deals and different things that you've done, I read that when you joined SoftBank the first time in the late 90s, one of the things that attracted you was that it was very founder friendly. Mm-hmm. It was CEO friendly, which is interesting because that was in the late 90s. So it does, there seems to be a correlation between the market timing and when people are founder friendly versus investor friendly. And I'd always thought that, you know, the founder friendly era started in the mid 2000s, but obviously in the late 90s, that was another era of founder friendly.
Sure. Well, I mean, founder friendly is just, I mean, again, it's a competitive market, and there are times when you're fighting others for deals, and there are times when the market is slower. And when the market is red hot, and as I say, it's a seller's market, an entrepreneur may say, I am going to go with the firm that doesn't impose governance on me. I can understand that. Hey, you know, I was an entrepreneur once too. And actually, even though DFJ was one of my investors and Hummer Winblad was one of my investors, both great venture firms, but my co-founder and I still owned the majority of the voting shares. So we had it naturally, right? We didn't have a super majority. We just didn't sell that much stock. And therefore, we, in essence, still controlled the company. And at a board meeting, when we ultimately decided to sell the company, I remember my investors saying to me, look, we'd like to keep going if you'd like to keep going. But at the end of the day, you're the CEO. It's you know, you guys, it's your company. And if this is the time you feel you should sell, then we respect that. And so I think there's a lot of, it's one thing to say, oh, we're founder friendly. We have these super majority things and we're fine with that. And it's another thing to say, look, I have great empathy for the founder. I have great empathy for the CEO. I know those jobs are hard. And I believe if you're not aligned with what they want to do, that's a really bad thing. But that doesn't mean you can't also have governance. You know, Anne Winblad was a fabulous, fabulous investor and a tremendous board member for me. Mm-hmm. And there were times she kicked my butt, you know, and called me on things and held me accountable for things and made me very uncomfortable. And you know what? That was awesome. Yeah. It wasn't awesome in the moment she was doing it, but it was the right thing to do to help the company make the right decisions. And so I think that there are, I think that to be a good investor and to be a good board member, you have to be willing to speak truth, even when it's unpopular. You have to be willing to hold people accountable, even if you don't have the legal authority, you know, maybe you have the moral authority, but you have to be able to do these things. And 99% of the time as an investor director, you are aligned with the company, right? Mostly you are aligned with the company. You want the company to be, you know, bigger. And in the times when you get unaligned, by nature is generally speaking when the company's raising money or selling.
Right.
And there I think it's just really important to be clear about the hats you wear.
Yeah.
And there are times when I'll say to the CEO, look, with my director hat on, mm-hmm. this is what I think you should do. But now with my investor hat on, this is how my partners are going to view it. And right. this is maybe how we're going to vote. I mean, there are rare cases where sometimes you may vote for something where you're voting for it as a director, but then your partners vote against it in the shareholder vote. I mean, it's rare and you try to avoid that sort of thing.
Right.
But at the end of the day, as a director, you do wear two hats. You have a fiduciary obligation to the company, and then you also have a fiduciary obligation to your LPs.
So this pendulum of kind of power or control, which is very important, if you think of economics, you know, economic rights or political rights, you know, at some level, when the investors take over, which if we think of the economic time now, it's going to be more of a market for, you know, investors and, you know,
maybe
we may see bad behavior coming in from the investor side and taking advantage of some down rounds, some situations. Now, hopefully not. And this is when, remember the days of the washouts and, you know, all these terms and, you know, full ratchets and liquidation participation rights, which for 10 years that didn't really exist. Right. So we may
but they're in the background and they've been
behind,
right. I mean, this is not, you know, I tell this to entrepreneurs all the time, those terms are not evil. They're not there because we're trying to cheat you. Mm-hmm. They're there because we are investing, you know, a lot of times I'll even say to entrepreneurs, do you know where our money comes from? Mm-hmm. Venture capitalists. And they'll say, rich people play money. I'm like, no, it comes from university endowments and retirement funds and teachers unions and, you know, mine workers and this and that. And, you know, it's a lot of this money we were not given the money and told to go gamble and have a good time. We're dealing with people's retirements and things like that. And so we have an obligation to try to return that money. And I think it's very important for entrepreneurs to understand that this isn't gambling money. This is money that we owe back to the entities that put it in. And so I don't think venture terms are inherently evil. They're there for reasons, and it's to try to protect the downside of these investments and to try to generate some return, because especially if you're in early stage, you know, half the deals don't return the capital because you're in a high risk business. And so the ones that do, you want to try to make that money back. And I think that entrepreneurs need to understand those going in, right? I've written a lot of blog posts.
Sure. I've read them. Yeah. Very good.
How to build a unicorn from scratch and walk away with nothing, where I try to explain it, because I think that entrepreneurs don't pay enough attention to the terms and why the terms are important and why they're valid. They're not, this isn't evil. It's the nature of the business. And so to your point, in a market, you know, sometimes if the market is really rampant, or if you happen to be the hottest deal of the century and multiple entities are competing, someone might give up the terms that are more protective on the downside. Someone might give you a higher valuation. You know, it's a market, and it's a negotiation, and those things may happen, and that's perfectly fine. But one more point on this is that I don't necessarily think that right now there's a lot of money in the market still. There's a lot of very large funds, and you know, people like me, we don't have to invest the money today or tomorrow or even this month or maybe even this quarter. But eventually, if investors don't invest, they don't get to keep their jobs either. And so there is a lot of capital that's been raised. There are a lot of businesses that are still fundamentally quite sound, even in this market. There are many that are very challenged, particularly consumer facing, having to do with travel, entertainment, that sort of thing. But there are other companies, you know, like Zoom, for example, to state the obvious, where as the world changes, it is giving them a tailwind. And so I think there will be, as there is often in markets like this, what we would call a flight to quality. And those companies are still going to have competitive term sheets, right? They're still going to get that money.
Yeah. And so one other way to look at this is, you know, you have on the one hand, the investor side, you have the founder side, and you have some of the independent directors that sometimes are put there to even out the vote or to have some tiebreaker. You know, one thing that I want to ask you, because you are the quintessential network director, very well known, and you probably know a lot of people in Silicon Valley. And by the way, that's one of the strengths of Silicon Valley, is that people have strong networks, and that has made deals go. You know, infamously, there is this side, if there's no conflict, there is no interest, right? That was attributed to John Doerr. But, you know, Delaware courts recently have cited and have said, look, many of these directors who are called independent are really not independent. And if you dig down into their background, they do have connections, and particularly social connections that make their judgment not independent. And I think this is something interesting to ask you, because you probably know everybody. So it would make you very hard to be considered independent in many cases, considering your, you know, very broad network. You know, it's case by case, and the, you know, a plaintiff or the defense would have to argue, you know, that you were independent. But that's an interesting question. And have you seen any repercussions in this side for you as an independent director, not talking about an investor?
Yeah. So not for me. Although I would say I don't do any private company independent director, because I think it would be in conflict with my job at Threshold. And so the only boards I serve on are the two public companies right now, MGT and Invitation Homes. And in both cases, they have nothing competitive or even that does business with any of the companies in my portfolio. Mm-hmm. So I don't feel, I was careful, right? I didn't pick something that would create a potential for conflict. I think that, I mean, this is a really challenging one because there are a lot of, you know, we get to know each other. You like someone, you work with them on one board, you recruit them to another board. For example, mm-hmm. I'm on two boards with Carl Bass, former CEO of Autodesk. Mm-hmm. Carl is the bomb. Like he's like the best director ever. He is amazing. And actually he just joined the Box board, which is another of our portfolio companies. Mm-hmm. Believe me, the fact if somebody went looked at this and said, oh my God, you know, Carl Bass is on three boards of the portfolio of Heidi's fund, she must control him. Well, then you don't know Carl Bass, right? I mean, there is no way. He's chosen. And in fact, interestingly, I joked with him about the Box board yesterday when I read he was joining the Box board. I'm like, oh, another one of our companies. And he said, oh, I didn't even know that. You know, it's a public company. I said, yeah, but we were the original investor. And one of my partners is still on the board there. So he didn't even know. He's like, oh, I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. but my point is that, yes, I think there are cases where there are people who hold independent seats, but they're being positioned by a venture firm, and all their boards are that old, that firm, and they're not paid by that firm, but they know their next board is coming from that firm. I think an entrepreneur has to look at that and say, is that person truly going to be an independent? Right. But I don't think you should throw the baby out with the bathwater, because a guy like Carl, you know, any board would kill to have somebody like Carl. I would gladly recruit him to every one of my portfolio companies if I could. Mm-hmm. And I have no doubt that he will act independently and I value that, right? I mean, I'm not trying to put him there as my spy, right?
Right.
But my point just being, I think every one of these cases is different.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
That, you know, and like I said, when it comes to public companies, I am more cautious about avoiding any potential even perception of a conflict like that.
Yeah. And so let's talk about public governance. One of the things that has been of late is this long-term versus short-term. And, you know, a lot of the private companies have the long-term vision and they don't want to go public. And in the public markets, we have all these shareholder activists, we have pressure from short sellers and others. Being on public boards, how do you think about that in terms of quarterly pressures or long-term, and has that been different in your perception and your thinking as a board member on either side?
Well, I think that the difference, so when we make an investment in a private company, you know, we're early stage investors, we're Series A investors. We are often going to be involved in that company for 7, 8, 9 years. In many of these companies, they don't even have a customer yet. They don't have a product yet. They're not in market. And so it's going to be years before they're even generating revenue and being in market. So they're different entities. And so they're not pressured to make the quarter, right? I mean, when a company gets bigger, you know, I'm on the board of Planet Labs, and they are a big revenue generating company. So one of the things we worry about is consistency of the growth of revenue, because of course that's when you get to a certain level of maturity, that's what you do. Other companies like Zooks and Memphis Meats, they're not revenue generating. So we don't have the pressure to make the quarter every quarter. We're not even selling anything yet. And some of these companies that are more the deep tech long gestation period companies, you don't have those pressures. And so you are, you're more focused on the long-term because you don't have the pressure of the short-term. That said, all companies, you know, you have limited capital and you have to stick to a budget and you have to stick to a plan of your progress. And generally these companies have competition, even if none of them are revenue generating yet. And so you have a lot of the same pressure, but you're not in the light of public companies. I think that the challenge in public companies is that we do have this, for the most part, this structure that requires sort of the quarterly performance and guidance, and in some ways a lack of the flexibility to say, well, gee, this quarter actually we're going to pivot something and we're going to invest a bunch of capital. And it makes it harder, actually, to make some of those investments when you see an opportunity and you're a public company director, because there are a lot of short-term considerations that are imposed by the market. And it's just the, you know, to me, it's sort of one of the costs of being public. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's different.
So one, you know, one difference may be the level of time that directors spend in public or private boards. And certainly the focus on, for example, board evaluations or CEO succession in public markets, they require, it's kind of a deeper question. And how do you think about board evaluation in public markets, in your public experience, and CEO succession? I mean, I've never really seen a board evaluation at a private company because people just think about growth, right?
You pretty much don't get to pick them anyway.
Right.
I mean,
right.
I joke with entrepreneurs, I'm like, be careful what VC you pick, because it's harder to divorce your VC than it is to divorce your spouse.
Right. Right.
So there is no getting rid of. I mean, in the boards I serve, the condition of investment is that we get a board seat, right?
Right, right. So nomination rights.
We might choose among our partners, and in some cases, we've allowed the companies, especially when we've had a partner transition, to choose the partner from among our partnership. But it's like you get to choose one of five people, not one of anyone in the world. And so, yeah, I think that it's important to evaluate boards. It's important to know why you have people on boards. I think that's why it's important also to have terms and have those terms be relatively short. And it is a little awkward, I'd say, in most companies. Again, it's a common topic of public company governance. It's like you get these barnacles in there and you can't get rid of them. And one of the things I do at DMGT, and Invitation Homes doesn't know this yet because I'm new there, but I'll do it, is every year, about 4 months before it's time for the election process, I'll call the CEO and the chairman and say, hey, I'm ready to not stand for a re-election unless you want me, right? I don't want to be on a board that doesn't want me and where I'm not adding value. And so I believe in self-regulating that. I mean, obviously those companies also have board evaluation processes, and sometimes you have more elaborate ones where you have 360s and you do something more. And, you know, every company is different, but I think that, again, I've been on seven or eight public boards now, and every one of them, I would say, a year or two in, you kind of know who's adding value, who's not, who's at the end of their arc. And I would say that as a group, you can be proactive about that. And maybe that is because I come from more of the private company world where that's what you do too, right? And you actually individually police, which sometimes isn't that popular, but sometimes you call someone after the meeting and say, hey, you were kind of a jerk in that, or you took up the airtime than you should have, or you really, didn't do the homework, or, you know, be honest with other people about your expectations and whether they're meeting them or not. I think that those are the kind of things that it's a big reason why the discussion around collegiality of boards is so important. That to me, collegiality doesn't just mean you're all nice and friendly to each other. It also means that you have the kind of working relationship where you can be honest with each other.
Right. And do you have any thoughts on the California law on diversity and how, California headquartered public companies now have a quota? Is this something that you see positively? How do you think about that?
This is such a tough one because I obviously, by definition, any board that has me on it is diverse. Mm-hmm. And I believe diversity is a good thing. I believe nature has taught us that diversity creates stronger organisms. And so I'm a big proponent of it. Mm-hmm. I wish that that the people who run other boards would have also seen that diversity is good and would have proactively gone out and tried to get that diversity without it being imposed. Mm-hmm. And I'm hopeful that instead of saying, oh, shoot, you know, now we have to have some women, so let's populate our board with the people we really want, and then let's check the box with a couple women. I think that you know, like anything in diversity, when you're hiring, you know, the problem is people do have a tendency to hire their own likeness. And it's harder to go find diverse candidates. They're just not as much in your network. They're just, it is just the way, is the way this stuff works. And as you know, most boards are still not using professional search and not imposing diverse, you know, this is a relatively recent thing. And yet I can tell you that I joke about this. I have more binders of women than Mitt Romney. I know lots of amazing qualified women. Now, the problem is, you know, what I used to see years ago, and it is changing now, where someone would say, oh, we're doing a search. And I'd say, well, tell me the criteria. And say, well, the first one is we want a woman, and the second one is she already has to have served on public board. And I said, well, you know, goodness sakes. I mean, if you start with that, you're not making the pool broader. You have to allow some people to serve on boards who haven't served before. And that's going to take some onboarding and some learning. But by God, these people are willing to do it. Mm-hmm. So I wish we didn't have to have a quota, but if it's forcing a change in behavior and if people are going in and thoughtfully saying, I don't want anyone to choose me for a board because I'm a woman.
Right.
I want to be chosen for a board because I am going to add a lot of value and I am going to be a great board member. And the fact that I'm a woman should then be the bonus, right? Oh, well, now we also can, check the box because we got one, but not, I don't want that to ever be the first or only reason that I'm being chosen. And if it is, then that's probably not going to be a good fit.
Yeah, no, it's very important. So to finish on the governance side, one of the trends has been this idea of stakeholder capitalism, where the focus of the corporation is no longer only building value for the shareholders in the long term, but now you got to think about your customers, the environment, your employees, and other constituents. You know, what do you think about this? And has it affected at all any of your views on what you do as a director?
Yes. First of all, I think it's an and, not an or. Mm-hmm. So I think that companies earn the right to satisfy a broader stakeholder base by also remaining viable. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is one of the challenges, right? If you over-index on things other than running the entity profitably, then ultimately you will not be allowed to stay in business. So there is a delicate balance here. And I think there are a lot of trade-offs that one can make that may cost you in the short term, but not in the long term. I think that there are things about going green in essence, where sometimes it's a short-term expense, but it's actually a long-term benefit. I personally think that investing in diversity and in education and in being a better member of your community, those things actually do ultimately make you a better company. And I think, again, then make you a company that is more sustainable from a revenue, profit, and growth perspective as well. And so there are sometimes short-term trade-offs, but they benefit in the long term. Mm-hmm. I think there are some things that are just the new realities of, you know, for example, I would say that as your customer base moves more into the millennial generation, you have a generation of people who are more attuned than perhaps my generation was on the downstream effects or the upstream effects of what that company does. And I think overall, that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. So I think that, and certainly right now in a COVID world, and hopefully someday soon in a post-COVID world, one of the things we recognize is we're all connected. And you don't live in an isolated world. And so worrying about some of these things is important, even if it heretofore hasn't been something that has been, or before now hasn't been considered necessarily best practice for good business, it's going to be going forward. Mm-hmm. So I don't see it as a bad thing. I think it's the evolution of the ever more connected world that we live in. And I try to pay attention to that and incorporate it, not only in the public companies, but also in the private companies. It's good hygiene, regardless of what size or stage you are.
Right. Well, at some level in a private company, you got to survive, you got to sell, you got to like grow. And so you may not have the benefit of, you know, of a public company that supposedly is already more stable and has revenue and can spend some of their time and other of these things.
Well, for example, I'll give you a really simple example.
Okay.
I really believe that profit-making public companies should have a charitable, you know, who should do some giving back to the community in the form of money.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that in non-revenue generating private companies, right? Their lives are serial. They're in a serial path. And before you can start giving money away, you have to start earning it yourself. So raising money from investors and turning around and giving it away is not the right thing to do. Now,
buying a Gulfstream jet, for example, right?
Exactly. I mean, allowing employees to have a certain amount of their time that they can go do something philanthropic or other, you know, there are other ways to give back. There are other ways to support your community that I think for startups are things one can do. You know, a lot of startups take a portion of their equity and put it in a charitable trust for the future. Mm-hmm. But until you're actually, you know, you've been given that money, or you've taken that money as an investment in order to use it to build your company so your company can be sustainable. And until you are,
right.
I don't think that money should be used for other purposes.
Okay, so we're going to now go with the rapid fire questions on the more personal side. So what are the 1 to 3 books that have greatly influenced your life?
Oh, gosh. Thinking Fast and Slow.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Atomic Habits. Definitely. And here's an odd one for you. Loving What Is.
Loving What Is.
Yeah.
What is that about?
It's about forgiveness.
Huh. Okay. That's great. Well, by the way, we'll add these in the episode notes so people can go and check them out.
Can I have one more? Split the Difference.
Which one?
Never Split the Difference.
Never Split the Difference. Okay. What is that about?
Negotiation.
Mm.
Fabulous book.
Okay. So, I suppose now I'm going to ask you a question on mentors, but you are famous for this. And so the question is, you know, who were your mentors and what did you learn from them? And how do you think about this? I read that when you left SoftBank, what you did was you created something called Mentor Capital. And so you have the word coined for this. So it'd be very interesting to hear your thoughts on this side.
First mentor was my father. He was an entrepreneur and believed everyone could be an entrepreneur, and he believed I could do anything I wanted, and that was super helpful. Other mentors have been, you know, I was lucky to work with Bill Gates early on in my life, and Bill is an amazing person to learn from. Ann Winblad, who I said earlier was one of our investors, has been a fabulous friend and mentor. Tina Seelig at Stanford, the mm-hmm. person that teach the Threshold Fellows program with, is an amazing instructor and mentor, and I learned so much from her. It's such a gift to work with her. So, I mean, mentors are all over the place. Emily Melton, my partner at Threshold, who, even though she is younger than I am, she has a lot of wisdom to share with me. And Josh Stein, the other co-managing director there, the two of them, I, you know, when I'm in a quandary, those are the two that I call and work things through. And I'm older than both of them, but that's okay. They can mentor the old lady too. So mentors come in all shapes and sizes.
Well, that's fantastic. And are there any quotes that you think of often or live your life by?
Yes. My favorite. I'll give you my favorite one.
Okay.
It's called the 20-40-60 rule. Mm-hmm. And Shirley MacLaine is the first person who said it, but I've said it so much that I think if you Google it, I come up a bit ahead of her. So I'm very sorry. But it goes like this. At 20, you're constantly worried about what other people think of you. At 40, you decide you're not going to give a damn about what other people think of you. And at 60, you come to realize that no one's actually thinking of you. And I love this quote. And now I'm in my 60s, so I've reached that age of enlightenment. But it's important to me because what it goes to, you know, I think people take themselves way too seriously, and I think people worry way too much about what other people think about them. And so it's very comforting to know that no one is really thinking about you. Like, you know, even your mom's probably not sitting around right now wondering what you're doing or if you're happy or, you know, whatever. But the flip side is neither is your boss, right? Neither is your hiring manager. Neither is the person who decides whether you get a raise or not. And so the flip side is when you understand that nobody's really paying attention to you or thinking of you, you realize that you really have to take control of your own life and you really have to advocate for yourself. And so I think that interesting combination of A, learning not to take yourself too seriously and not to worry that much about what other people think, but B, understand that you have to take control of your own life and be your own advocate, are the two sides of that coin of the 20-40-60 rule. And that's why I love it so much.
Yeah, that's excellent. Love it. So what is an unusual habit or an absurd thing that you love?
In my spare time, I am a glass artist.
Oh, wow.
And I'm learning to create pieces of glass. And I really enjoy doing that.
Huh. So like, give me an example. What could you, like a vase?
Or dishes or plates. I made all my dining ware. I made a really kick-ass chandelier for my house. It's a really giant chandelier that I handmade and with my daughter, and it took us like 6 months to make it. And it's very cool.
Wow, that's cool. Okay, and the last question is, which living person do you most admire?
Are a lot of people for a lot of different things, but right now Bill Gates is at the top of my list. I think Bill and Melinda, really. Can I name two?
Sure.
Because they really do this together. The fact that they're taking all their wealth and applying it to trying to solve some of the world's biggest problems and doing it right now when they are getting attacked for it and misunderstood and still they continue. I am in awe of that and extremely appreciative.
Yeah, it's really remarkable the way he shifted from his focus at Microsoft and doing philanthropy. I mean, it's very unique. And he does have now this aura of like, you can trust what he says. It's amazing, his focus.
I am in awe of both of them. They are an amazing team. And what they're doing is really, I think 100 years from now, when people look back at Bill and Melinda, you know, Microsoft's going to be the footnote. And what they do as philanthropists are really going to be what people talk about.
Okay. Well, that's amazing. Well, I appreciate a lot you coming in here and carving out your time for this. And governance is a critical part of what we do. And I feel like it's not talked enough and people think of the business side, but there are a lot of things in the governance side that are very important. And you have a lot of experience in that side of the business world. Where can people find you if they want to search, you know, your writings or your investment? What do you have available?
Website at HeidiRoizen.com, and you can email me at Heidi@threshold.vc.
Okay. All right, Heidi, thank you very much. I hope you stay well, and we'll be in touch soon, and I'll talk to you soon.
I enjoyed this a lot, and I appreciate all the work that you're doing.
All right. Thank you.
All righty.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. If you like what you heard, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast with your friends or colleagues. If you'd like to reach out to me, you can find me on LinkedIn or Twitter at Evan Epstein. You can also check out all the details related to this podcast at www.boardroom-governance.com.